Hello and welcome to the Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name is Paul Malik. I am the Courier's political editor, and I am joined today from journalists in Edinburgh and Dundee. In Edinburgh, we have the Press and Journal's political editor, Andy Phillip. Good morning, Andy. And joining me in Dundee this week is TV's very own David Clegg, the editor of The Courier. Good morning, guys. How are we?
Very well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Thank you for joining us. Andy, are you all right?
All good here.
Great stuff. Let's crack on. We are in the last week of the election campaign, and what an exciting campaign it has been.
You liar.
I know, I'm being deadly serious. There's nothing but truth coming from me there. It's been an interesting campaign, hasn't it? In the sense that it doesn't really feel like it's even started yet, and here we are.
Well, I don't understand. Why is that? Why is it? Is it COVID? Is it the fact that it just feels like it hasn't taken off at all? Like I recorded a podcast with Frank O'Donnell, the P&J editor, and we said how this was the most important Holyrood election of devolution. And, you know, I think arguably that is true. We made a good case for that, but you couldn't have told that really, because it doesn't really feel like it's came alive at all. Is it because the results are foregone conclusion or what?
Yeah, because we end up talking about something as simple as will the SNP get a majority or not? And as Nicola Sturgeon was pointing out on the TV debate the other day, she points out that no one else is even in the ring, you know, to be First Minister. They're all competing for either to be a block on the SNP or to take second place. It's not quite the, you know, the horse race that it should be.
But it has felt similar in a lot of ways, but I guess not getting out to jobs or not getting out to actually follow candidates has been a bit weird. And I'm not even getting a sort of feel for other patches or other areas, because, you know, during a normal campaign, reporters would be out and about in maybe a wee bit further afield than P&J patch or Courier patch, maybe sometimes as far away as Stirling.
get a nosebleed.
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard of this place.
The centre of civilization. But, you know, I've only been out on one job. Andy, have you been out on any?
No, I went to Edinburgh for the first time this year, just the other week, which, you know, shows how different things are now.
I ventured all the way to the City Square in Dundee to see Alex Salmond and about 25 other people.
It's a far cry.
Far cry from what it used to be.
So I guess the difference that makes is that it's harder to get a sense of what the public are thinking about it. We've got polling, obviously, but there's not that, what's the reaction like on the doorstep? Dynamic. And also, I think, you know, canvassing must have been more difficult. They're allowed to canvass now, but I think the rules on canvassing just changed a couple of weeks ago. So it has been a very strange election. But I think, you know, those are the practical implications of COVID. It feels to me like, you know, just the public being still very focused on coronavirus and coming out of the pandemic and not really having that much bandwidth left for thinking about an election, especially an election, as we've said, where the result seems like a bit of a foregone conclusion. So,
but that's what we've been talking about as well, Andy, isn't it? You know, it's such an interesting one in the sense that if people have got COVID recovery at the forefront of their mind, because you do, regardless of what industry you're in or what you're doing, that's all we've been doing for the last year. And yet, it seems like, yet again, the election's going to be done on constitutional lines, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's split down the middle. And the last poll we saw put it pretty much exactly where we were in 2014. So you sort of think, well, has that all been worth it then? It's just a complete war of attrition. And we're right back to where we started. And, you know, there might not be anything conclusive this election either. We might end up pretty much where we are.
I guess, though, I think, Paul, you started there by saying there's, you know, the two questions we're answering in this election. One is, do the SNP get a majority? And the second is it Labour or the Tories that come second? That first question about whether the SNP get a majority or not feels like it's pretty important as regards to what happens next in terms of a second referendum and all the rest of it. You guys are in the Zoom huddles with the politicians? Has that been the
That's the complete focus.
Yeah,
and that's why even when Nicola Sturgeon put out her plan for the first 100 days of an SNP government, there was no mention of a referendum in there. So all of the opposition parties seized on it, saying, well, that's it. She's only putting off independence for the first 100 days. So it is, even when there's an absence of the constitutional argument, it immediately turns back to it, because that's where they see, you know, particularly the Conservatives, that's where they see their main slogan. So they don't have another big hitting piece unless they can say that if the SNP get a majority, that's it, UK is over.
Yeah, I mean, Andy, you know, we've talked about it, how it's almost like a Groundhog Day effect. In 2014, I wasn't a journalist. I had a much more admirable career in retail management, and so I was looking at the IndyRef in 2014, and even the election in 2015 from the other side. How similar is it? I mean, the same old arguments seem to be coming up with RBS and the moving and the construction of a hard border. We've even had some MSPs suggest that the hard border could create jobs, but you guys were both there in 2014. How similar is this beginning to feel?
I mean, so I was on the ground with Andy covering the first referendum, and then 2015, 2016, 2017. And the arguments remain pretty much the same. It's interesting watching this from a slightly different perspective, where I'm not on the day-to-day political reporting anymore. Brexit has changed the dynamic a little, but Brexit seems to have receded. The Brexit doesn't seem to have been a major component of the discussion in this election, as far as I can see. And we are, when it gets to independence, you know, what we're hearing, currency, what's the economic case, isn't the deficit going to be high, oil price, and what the impact that has with the limited shelf life of the oil industry and revenues for public expenditure from that. The border issue, actually, I think this is, you know, there's been a sense of that in the last few days, because the border issue has been made more complicated by Brexit. You know, the border was with an independent Scotland and a remaining United Kingdom, both of which were in the EU, wouldn't have been a problem on borders, and that was pretty clear in 2014. There is going to be a border issue now, and you know, I think despite attempts to minimise it, the, you know, trauma trying to sort out the Irish land border in the last few years has shown that there is a great difficulty there in making that work, and it could have economic consequences. So I think that the arguments are largely the same, but they're framed in a slightly different way now. And also, I think that's partially because the Scottish government and the SNP haven't really done a lot of work on making a new case. What does the argument for independence look like now, now that the contours of the Brexit deal are a wee bit clearer? That's something they're going to have to do. They're going to have to recalibrate that argument for the new reality. And until they do that, I suppose the arguments are going to feel very similar, because it feels like it's just muscle memory of the yes side saying what they said in 2014 and the no side saying what they said in 2014, which isn't getting us anywhere by any means. And I think both sides need fresh arguments and fresh counter arguments.
On the Brexit, the similarities are interesting, because the emotional attachment to the European Union was a driving force at the time, but it's melted away quite fast. You know, it gets crowded out pretty quickly by just the practicalities of, well, okay, well, what happens when Scotland is independent and has to look at a border if that was to happen? Rather than the emotional desire to want to rejoin the European Union, That's gone very fast. When you think about what we were all talking about just last year, or even at the very, you know, just around about the general election, when this was everything that mattered. Now it's not a case about, well, how do we get back into the European Union? It doesn't seem. If you look at the last poll, in fact, the ranking of orders of what people think is important, Brexit was really high a year ago, and it's disappearing. It's about half as important to people as it was last time. So the more practical day-to-day issues are much more at the forefront of people's mind.
And I suppose that will be a knock-on effect of coronavirus as well. You know, if, you know, what's the point of thinking about getting into France if you can't even get into Fife? Which is a little soundbite that other people can use if they feel like they need to.
The ship in Anele, its beer garden is open.
So is it?
That is somewhere where I'm quite keen to get to. I'm just working out who I can get to drive me there and back so that I can have a drink while I'm there.
Just take the reliable bus service.
Yeah.
Is that where they do the cricket on the beach?
Yeah. I got married nearby and we played cricket on the beach the day after. It was brilliant. Although my brother did his cruciate ligament during that game, which caused him some trauma. There's an anecdote I didn't expect to be telling on a politics podcast.
As welcome it was too.
You heard it here first. I mentioned earlier, I descended upon Dundee City Square on Tuesday, Wednesday. It feels so long ago now. To meet with the former First Minister, Alex Salmond, and the Agaba Party supporters, which was really quite interesting for a number of reasons. He mentioned his last visit to Dundee, or his last official visit to Dundee, which was in 2014, where he could barely get from one end of the town to the next during the sort of final days of the referendum campaign.
I made that walk with him. I was there for that. I covered that, and he did. He was absolutely mobbed, deluged by supporters that day. I think it was August 2014. It was like the Beatles walking down Dundee High Street in the 60s.
I think I might have been working in said retail environment at the time. Looked out the window, stealing all my customers. What's going on? But yeah, it was, I mean, it didn't help that it was absolutely pouring with rain. But there was quite a lot of insight gained from it nonetheless. Needless to say, he's always niggled away at the BBC, but it was almost Trump-esque in his sort of denouncing of the media. The Press and Journal and the Courier turn up because we always would. And Sky News had also appeared as well. So I wouldn't say that he was being completely ignored by, you know, some of the world's larger media organizations.
I mean, that's one of the interesting things about his trajectory, isn't it? I mean, that Alaba launch where every crank and zoomer was of the Scottish independence blogging community was on the call, like really, really unpalatable people that he now associates with. And I think, you know, It feels like an easy dig, but actually I think it speaks to a wider point that he was mobbed in City Square in Dundee in 2014, that he was a very important and, you know, impressive figure that was, you know, bringing the British state, rocking the British state to its foundations. And now he's a rather sad, diminished figure hanging out with internet cranks and trying to get votes from people that are on the rather extreme end of the independent spectrum.
Because there's a release today, Andy, that we were talking about. What has he described the five main political parties as?
Yeah, this the former First Minister, former SNP leader, is now resorting to putting press releases out where he refers to them with all the other Holyrood parties as one of the feeble five, which my eyes just, you know, juddered to a halt when I got to this part of the quote, because, you know, he's in where is he? He's in Stirling. No, Falkirk. He's in Falkirk today, and he's having a go at the BBC. He's not just having a go at them anymore. He's having a go at everybody, and he's trying to sort of show how he can get round the BBC's what he calls a broadcast ban with an innovative grassroots campaign, which I think just means people standing in the street waving placards, which I'm not sure is the same thing. But yeah, this idea that he thinks the BBC are sticking to an out-of-date formula, he's not being allowed on the airwaves, and the whole idea of the Lib Dems slipping behind them in terms of public support, and he thinks it's unfair that the ALPA party only get a bare fraction of the coverage, as he says, allocated to the feeble five. I would never really have guessed that this is what we would be talking about a couple of years ago.
It's taken quite the turn, hasn't it?
It's I wrote this in a piece recently, but he has had the most breathtaking and astonishing fall from grace of any politician who's ever held high elected office in Scotland and possibly the UK, from someone who could have been one of the great political legends in Scottish history. He's now someone reduced to appearing on Putin TV making transparently nonsensical remarks about the media in this country and hanging out with cranks.
Well, what happens though if he gets elected? Because he's going to be in the Scottish Parliament standing right there next to Nicola Sturgeon again. And as we've seen today, she was picked up on that in a radio interview where, you know, there will come a time, if that were to pass, that the SNP might have to decide what to do about a motion about a very quick move towards a an independence referendum.
Now, David, you interviewed the First Minister for the Election Hub Live, but before we get into that, let's hear a word from Press and Journal Editor-in-Chief Frank O'Donnell.
Get the facts and analysis you need about the things that matter to you this Holyrood election with DC Thompson Media. Our groundbreaking data research, video bulletins, independent opinion and expert reporting from our dedicated politics team is now yours free for 30 days. That's right, 30 days of free, unlimited web access to The Courier or The Press and Journal to help you make an informed decision this May. New customers only, you can cancel at any time. Sign up at thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed.
So yeah, David, you've interviewed all of the leaders over the course of this campaign, fronting up our online coverage, which has been different and refreshing to be a part of. But you sat down with Nicola Sturgeon on Thursday at Meadowside, and it was quite a revealing interview. Mainly so, you know, how personal it seemed to get at points, you know. Watching it, it felt as if the First Minister was the most vulnerable on camera in interview than she's been, I'd say, in at least the last 18 months. And what an 18 months that she has had in terms of First Minister and leader of the SNP. What were your first impressions of it? Did she come across like that?
I think so. I mean, I had watched a few of the other sit-down interviews with her because we're trying to do... It's a bit of a strange format because what we're doing is we're filming the interviews the last 20 or 25 minutes. We're putting them on our website, but obviously we're also using that as an interview for our website and also that we use in the paper as well. So if you're doing the traditional newspaper interview, which isn't recorded, your ambition really is to just get a news line for the story. But when you're actually the whole 25 minutes are going on the website, and we've made a commitment to put them up unedited so that you would see exactly how the interview went. There's no tricks, there's no changes. That means you have to modify how you do it a little bit because you're trying to make it something that's worth listening to for the full 25 minutes. And what you find on the TV interviews is that they tend to be shorter than that. And also they're just, you know, stuff about policy and trying to catch her out, which had been done pretty extensively by this point and I wasn't that interested in. So I just thought that, you know, the last time I'd seen her was, as I say, as the start of the interview, the last time I'd seen her was the 20th of March last year. I had been at the Alex Salmond trial for the last day of evidence there. And I was just getting into the car to drive back to Dundee and a calling note came in to say that the government were going to be holding a media briefing about the coronavirus situation. So I spoke to our news desk and thought, listen, we don't have anyone nearby to go, so why don't I just go myself because I'm in the area. So I went along and it was Catherine Calderwood was the chief medical officer at the time. She had her trips to Fife had not yet got her into trouble. And Nicola Sturgeon then, I came in, and obviously we were all aware that this was going to be a very difficult situation, but I hadn't seen her for a couple of months because I was off the politics beat. I was editing the paper by that point, and she looked really worried. She was, you know, pale and clearly anxious. And it was a very memorable moment for me. But when it dawned on me just how serious this situation was, and that even the chief medical officer and the First Minister were clearly very, very scared about what was going on. And obviously we had lockdown a few days later and all the rest of it. So fast forward to this interview, I just asked her about how were you feeling? And I think, you know, there's an element of she talks about the human aspect that the last year has had on her, but It has political implications too, because I've seen quite a bit of commentary in other places about, you know, she looks tetchy, she looks knackered, but, you know, understandably, who wouldn't be knackered over the last year because we got COVID, and that's before the whole Alex Salmond committee and all that situation, which we don't have time to get into here. So I do get the sense, you know, that it has been an experience that has changed her. And I ask her, you know, has it changed her approach to being first minister or how she views the job? Now, obviously, in an interview taking place 1 week before the election, she's not going to be too forthcoming about what her future plans are. I asked her if she would stand another term, because I think there's lots of, certainly on Twitter, there's lots of speculation about whether she'll stand again in the next election and what will happen. So there is personal stuff there. I should say this interview is available on the Courier and the Press and Journal website, and we also discuss some policy. We discuss the independence referendum and the timing of that. But yeah, I think you're right. That one of the interesting things for me was just trying to get a little bit under the skin of how the COVID experience has altered her impressions of the job.
And it comes across that way. I think, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, someone who's had to keep such a stoical face on, regardless of what you think of the First Minister's politics, you know, and the thing with the Prime Minister in a lot of ways is that they have still had the burden of leadership placed on them. And it does seem at times that Nicola Sturgeon has accepted that it is a burden rather than a sort of birthright almost, which some other leaders might, you know, struggle with.
Well, there is an interesting dynamic there, and we maybe don't have much time to get into it, but I think there is a general acceptance from people that, you know, this has been a burden for Nicola Sturgeon and she's had a lot to deal with, and we should be, you know, regardless of your politics, there should be an element of gratitude for her service in that regard. Boris Johnson doesn't get the same credit, does he? I mean, you very rarely hear about the personal cost of steering the country through coronavirus from Boris Johnson. And he got the bloody virus.
He was
in intensive care.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in that, really. Is it just, Andy, have you any thoughts on why that is? Is it because he's just because of his nature?
I think so. When you look at the chaos that's been unleashed by some of the more recent comments, it's because Nicola Sturgeon herself would refer to this too. It's like the things that are attributed to Boris Johnson, you think, well, that could be believable. Do we trust him? Does he mean what he says? Is everything a big, huge mirage? And unfortunately for Boris Johnson, that is what's come back to bite him. Because like you say, the man was in a hospital bed. You know, the guy, he has had to lead the UK, come up with some enormous decisions about life-changing, you know, life-affecting policies. But it comes down to he's got so much baggage about how he's conducted himself in the past that people seem prepared to overlook that sort of serious nature that has to come along with leadership and see him almost as the sort of the clown figure. And that's caused him a lot of reputational damage.
Well, there's one thing about the UK is that some of our sort of older leaders do get a bit of revisionist history closer to the end, just like a Prince Philip. He's enjoyed an easier time of it as of late, you know, despite the fact that he said some pretty monstrous things as well. There was a bit of a faux pas during the interview though, David. And I think we do have to say the Stoosh of the Week, which is a sort of middling feature that I came up with. And I'm going to take full credit for this because it hasn't been in for a while. The listener has been calling for it. So
is the listener your mum?
My mum refuses. We've discussed this. My mum refuses to listen to it because I don't pronounce my words properly.
I can't believe your enunciation is costing us our one listener.
I know. It's just, well, we're award nominated though.
It's true. We're going to win it. We're going to win an award in 2021.
Absolutely.
That is my ambition for this podcast.
It was shortlisted for two, news and politics, at the Publishers Podcast Awards. We didn't win, but it's...
Who beat us? I forgot to check.
The New Statesman and...
Never heard of them.
New Statesman.
Is it the Statesman? No, it is the New Statesman.
It was the New Statesman.
Producer Chris has had to come in here to fact check us. Yeah, okay.
And the Weekend Wrapped, which is excellent.
Oh, I thought we would just be dismissive of the other podcasts, regardless of their quality. Are we being more generous than that?
We're being gracious.
Okay.
Yes. Gracious in defeat. And I certainly didn't take last week off the podcast to commiserate. We have the Stoosh of the Week. The Stoosh of the Week has to go to Nicola Sturgeon, who got the name of Dundee City Council's SNP administration leader wrong. She was just distracted by you, I think, David, but she did call him David Alexander when his name is John. So, Nicola Sturgeon, you are Stoosh of the Week.
Stoosh of the Week.
Yeah, so I didn't pick her up on it at the time, so I asked her about the Eden Project coming to Dundee because I was trying to get a financial commitment out of her. So she did commit to the government financially contributing to the cost of bringing the Eden Project to Dundee if the feasibility study, which is going on at the minute, proves valuable. And she said that she'd been shown this stuff about the project by David Alexander. Of course, the SNP Dundee City Council leader is John Alexander. I didn't mention the interview. The minute we finished recording, I said, I don't want to ruin your day, First Minister, but the SNP council leader in Dundee is not David Alexander, as you said. It's John Alexander. And if you go on my Twitter feed, you'll see a picture of her reaction, which was to bend down, throw her head in her hands, and then utter a four-letter word, which we could not put on a family podcast.
John.
So she was joking. She took it in good humor, but I believe she did text Mr. Alexander shortly afterwards to apologize and tell him that we would likely be making fun of him for this, which of course she was right about, because we're making fun of him in the paper today, and we also are doing it in this podcast.
John's a good lad, and any abuse, please send David Clegg's way, not mine. Elections and votes aren't all serious in their nature, of course. Andy, you have been diving into the world of playlists this week with none other than Scottish Labour leader Anna Sarwar. What has he been listening to on his Vinga bus as he travels along the M8 and then sometimes north?
Yeah, it was a discussion I wasn't expecting, but I thought it was quite endearing, actually. But it turns out that Pauline McNeill, Scottish Labour MSP in the last session, made an ass a wee mixtape to take on his campaigning drives up the motorway and into Aberdeen. But unfortunately, an ass admitted to me that she got pretty much his entire musical taste wrong, and he's not been listening to much. But he divulged some of the tunes that he's been listening to pep him up, because I think, obviously, every election, every show, everything needs a soundtrack. But Anas Sarwar apparently listens to, if anyone can guess what he listens to get himself all pumped up and ready for the big debates.
No, you're not going to tell me that it's Eye of the Tiger, are you?
It's Eye of the Tiger, David.
My goodness. Could he be more of a cliche?
Does he have a little shadow boxing routine that he does before?
I was so impressed with his really, you know, left field choice there that I didn't ask him about that. But we've seen his dance routines already on numerous social media.
Can you imagine the like post-election party if the leaders got together and we're listening to Eye of the Tiger and Atomic Kitten and God knows what else?
I know. I feel there's a feature brewing here, but I need to get hold of, because I mean, He has forgone a mixtape, which has obviously been lovingly crafted, and gone for things like Eye of the Tiger. He also likes a bit of Where Is the Love by Black Eyed Peas, and then told me alarmingly that when he was feeling a bit more loving, he likes to listen to Kendrick Lamar's Pray For Me and Frankie Valli's I Love You Baby.
What does he mean by a little bit more loving?
I don't know.
Perhaps we shouldn't speculate on that.
Is that Kendrick Lamar album? Not quite. It's quite an aggressive hip hop album, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I may have. I think he was actually talking about Frankie Valli when he was saying
not Kendrick Lamar.
Not Kendrick Lamar. Yeah, I think I may have lumped them together by accident.
If the political journalism doesn't work out, the music journalism lark isn't going to work out either, Andy.
No, that's true. Yeah, but however, I was obviously still coming to terms with the. This is clearly what he was listening to before the TV debate. Eye of the Tiger. So you can watch it again now, knowing that. It's public service.
I think I'll pass.
That means, do you think that Douglas Ross listens to Hole Again after he's had his debates, you know, where he's been torn to shreds?
Did you discuss it on the podcast last week? I haven't managed to catch up with last week's yet.
No, I don't believe we did.
So the full horror of the Atomic Kitten dance has not been addressed on this issue?
No.
No, it hasn't. Okay. I mean, it's still difficult to come to terms with, I have to admit.
They thought that, I got the impression it was because he'd had one pint in the space of 5 minutes. And
I think it goes
to your head. And none of us have been drinking anyway. So
The thing that I thought about the Atomic Kitten thing is it aged him almost precisely. You can tell exactly what age Douglas Ross is because he must have been 18 or 19 when Atomic Kitten's Hole Again came out, because they would be the only people who would still be dancing to it in 2021.
Yeah, I believe that knocked Limp Bizkit off the charts, which is a little 11-year-old I was really, really upset about. So there's an aging thing for me.
Please don't do a dance to whatever Limp Bizkit.
Rolling.
Yeah.
Now we'll save that one for the studio. We'll save that if we win the podcast award, then I'll do the Rolling dance.
Given the meandering nature of today's episode, that seems unlikely.
That's almost all we have time for, gents. Thank you very much for joining us. But David, there was another nice little anecdote that came out of the Nicola Sturgeon interview involving our Merseyside doorman and security guard, Alan.
Yeah, it was good fun. Alan is a big Nicola Sturgeon fan for whatever reason, and he also likes Jenny Godley, the comedian who's been doing the voiceovers on Twitter of the Nicola Sturgeon briefings. So I arrived to Meadowside yesterday to prepare for the interview and found that Alan had changed his name badge so it said Frank, in the hope that when Nicola Sturgeon arrived, she would say "Get the door," which is the "Get the door, Frank" is the catchphrase. So, wise to this, I sent advance warning to the First Minister, who was making her way from Aberdeenshire to Dundee, that the doorman was a big fan and was doing a Frank get the door bit. So when she arrived, she said, "Frank, get the door," and made his day. And he also got a selfie with her afterwards. So regardless of the nature of the interview, there was one person who was happy that the First Minister was in Meadowside yesterday.
That's all we can hope for.
I like good news stories like that. Yeah.
On a serious note, Alan's been on security in the building, which has been pretty much empty for over a year now because we've all been home working. So it was nice to see him, but it was also nice that he could got to make his day.
That is nice, and it's a nice one. Jenny Godley, of course, once called me Meatloaf. So
why did she call you Meatloaf?
I don't know. It was during the First Minister's briefing, and the camera panned on my face for some reason, and she went, "Not you, Meatloaf."
We'll need to get your name badge changed as well, Paul.
On that note, thank you for joining us for another Stushy. We'll see you same time as on the same place on your podcast provider for next week. Thanks to Andy, David, and producer Chris. I've been Paul Malik. Cheers. Bye.
The Stushy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stushy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stushy or follow Stushy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe. Or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.